Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Alexis McLeod, and Sarah Tyson. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books in a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Travis Dumsday, associate professor of philosophy at Concordia University of Edmonton. His new book, Dispositionalism and the Metaphysics of Science, is just out from Cambridge University Press. Dispositionalism is the view that there are irreducible causal powers in nature that explain why objects behave as they do. To say that salt is soluble in water, for example, is to say that salt has the disposition to dissolve in water, and this disposition is understood as a real causal power of the salt. In his new book, Dumsday articulates a novel version of dispositionalism, which he calls nomic dispositionalism, and he considers its relation to a cross-section of fundamental debates and positions in the metaphysics of science. These include the nature of scientific laws, the possibility of knowledge about unobservable entities, and whether there is any fundamental material stuff. So the book doubles as a concise and easily accessible introduction to many of the core debates in the metaphysics of science, as well as a defense of an intriguing new view of dispositionalism. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Travis. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Hi, Carrie. Thanks very much.
So this is, you know, a great book. It's an excellent tour of the metaphysics of science, besides being a defense of dispositionalism. So a lot of the, you know, I'd say pretty much all of the basic issues that arise in the metaphysics of science on, you know, realism versus anti-realism and material composition and causality. I think the only one that's not directly, I think, addressed may be reduction, although you do talk about emergence, so that's also important. So it's an excellent review of a lot of these issues before you actually get into the nitty-gritty of defending a particular position in some very unique and interesting ways. So before we begin to talk about particular topics within the book, maybe you can tell us a bit about yourself and how you got to philosophy and how you came to write the book.
Sure. Well, I sort of became obsessed with philosophy pretty early on when I was in high school, in fact. And so professional trajectory was pretty clear from fairly early on. I did my undergrad, you know, as a double major in philosophy and poli sci at Carleton University in Canada, MA at Waterloo, and then I went to University of Calgary for my PhD, where I worked with Mark Arashefsky, philosophy of science. And so philosophy of science has been my main field of specialization, still that occupies a lot of my attention, but I work in a few other areas as well. I try to keep broad interests in a few different research areas going.
Okay. So let's talk about dispositions, right? I mean, that's the main idea of the book. what's a disposition? You know, what is your dispositionalist view? Just to start us off.
Well, as you'd expect, a lot of these notions are contested, but the way I like to think about dispositionalism, it's the affirmation that there are irreducible causal powers in nature, where powers, I think, should be understood, at least initially, pretty broadly. So in my view, so most people think about dispositions in terms of dispositional properties, right? So we think about something like fragility. You know, a vase is fragile, and so that's one of its dispositional properties. Or, you know, in fundamental physics, you might talk about mass or charge being dispositional properties, you know, because they're causal powers that objects possess. But dispositionalism, I think, has a broader scope. I think there are other ontological categories that we can also attribute. You know, we can also describe using powers language. So in some parts of the book, I talk about how in the literature on ontic structural realism, for instance, there's ongoing discussion about dispositional relations. You know, are there certain kinds of relations or structures that are inherently causally significant? Same thing with the notion of dispositional substances or objects. The notion that, so in other words, disposition, the basic notion is an irreducible causal power, but power should be understood broadly as sort of cross-cutting ontological categories. I think it's more than just properties.
Okay, and you also mentioned a number of different varieties of dispositionalism. Which is the one that you support most or think is the strongest?
Yeah, there are lots of different versions of dispositionalism and internal debates within dispositionalism about how best to understand the view. So, for instance, one debate that I talk about a couple of times in the book has to do with how dispositionalism is to be understood vis-a-vis other kinds of properties. So, for example, and again, property, although I tend to take a broader view, most people do talk about dispositions primarily in terms of properties, and so that's reflected in this particular internal discussion. But one debate has to do with the status of non-dispositional properties. So, for instance, you know, think of something like shape, the shape squareness or something like this. At least at first glance, shape doesn't seem to have any intrinsic causal import. It seems like we can distinguish between, you know, a square shape and a kind of causal power. And so some people use shape as a paradigm example of a non-dispositional property, or what's sometimes called a categorical property. And so one of the debates within dispositionalism that I talk about in the book has to do with the status of non-dispositional properties. So some dispositionalists adopt what's called the mixed view, according to which some properties are irreducibly dispositional and some properties aren't. You know, some properties are just categorical, like shape, for instance, or certain kinds of qualitative properties. So that's one stance one might take as a dispositionalist, right? You might say that, you know, some properties are dispositional, other properties aren't. The key thing, though, is that, you know, there are dispositions. Another take on this, though, is kind of a much more hardcore view of dispositionalism that says that all properties fundamentally are dispositional. And so what we think of as categorical properties like shape or certain kinds of qualities, those are either reducible to dispositions or they're just not real at all. And that's called pan-dispositionalism. So we've got the mixed view that says, you know, powers are real, but so are categorical properties. You've got pan-dispositionalism that wants to say that, you know, there's only powers, right? All properties are dispositional in nature. There's another very interesting notion, a third view called the identity theory. This is defended by people like John Hyle, where the view is that all properties are both categorical and dispositional in nature. So they have both categorical and dispositional identity conditions. So that they're kind of, some people describe this as a view that the properties are kind of two-sided. They've got a dispositional aspect and a categorical aspect. That's a slightly tricky way of putting it, but that's how it's sometimes described. And finally, you've got a fourth major view called neutral monism that says that in a way, properties are neither dispositional nor categorical. These are conceptual distinctions rather than really ontological distinctions. So at bottom, for neutral monists, properties do have an intrinsic nature, and that intrinsic nature can be described accurately using categorical concepts or using dispositional concepts. But fundamentally, properties themselves are neither dispositional nor categorical, ontologically. These are just concepts that we apply to them.
Okay, and of these four, which is the one that you prefer?
I very much prefer the first view, the mixed view, that says that dispositions are real, but so are categorical properties, and we need both of these categories as irreducible features of nature.
Okay, good. We need them. What do we need them for? I guess that's, since we're talking about the metaphysics of science and what science sort of needs things for, it's often for some sort of explanation. In order to, as people in philosophy of science will say, to provide truth makers for particular claims in science. Could you say something about the role that dispositions, or categorical, but the dispositions are supposed to play in science?
Yeah. Well, it's good that you brought in the truth maker language. I think that's helpful here. In my view, the metaphysics of science, science itself is really about trying to explain and predict the behavior of objects. And we want to know why things behave the way they do. And when we understand why they behave the way they do, then we can predict their behavior. That to me is a fundamental part of the nature of the scientific project. So if that's what science, if that's largely what science is about, trying to explain and predict the behavior of objects, when we think about the metaphysics of science, that immediately raises certain closely related questions. What is the nature of an object? What kind of substance ontology should we be working with? Especially with fundamental physics, but then also this notion of behavior and what explains the behavior of objects. And that's really where the dispositions will come in, trying to account for regular behavior of substances. And of course, there's different ways you can try to do this in metaphysical terms. So one way to understand dispositionalism is by looking at some of its close competitors. So dispositionalism, as we noted before, this is a claim about the causal powers of objects. And so the dispositionalists will want to say objects behave the way they do because they have certain intrinsic causal powers. And, those powers can be stimulated in various ways, resulting in certain kinds of behavior. And so the behavior of objects, and in particular, their regular patterns of behavior, can be explained in terms of their intrinsic causal powers. So if that's the dispositionalist view, what are the competitors claiming? Well, one major kind of competing theory here in terms of explaining the behavior of objects is what's sometimes called nomological necessitarianism. Nomological necessitarianism. This is the view that laws of nature are real, irreducible factors in reality. The nature of laws is understood somewhat differently by different advocates of this view, but one particularly prominent version of this that is defended by people like Tim Maudlin, for instance, is a kind of primitivist view of laws, according to which laws are understood as abstract, transcendent entities that somehow play a governing role in nature. So the notion would be something like you've got abstract mathematical equations, like the equations, for instance, that describe Newton's laws, like one example. And these abstract mathematical equations, despite being abstract, and so not really concrete entities per se, despite being abstract, they somehow manage to govern the behavior of concrete entities in nature. And so that would be a competing view, whereby the behavior of objects is explained by reference to these transcendent, abstract, governing principles, rather than intrinsic powers of the relevant objects themselves. So nomological necessitarianism is a major competing view. It's one of the views that dispositionalism sort of has to contend with. And then a third major competing view is regularity theory, the sort of neo-Humean view, according to which there really is no deeper explanation as to why objects behave the way they do. The regular behavior of objects is just a primitive feature of nature that has no further deeper explanation. So regularities are there, they're real, but nothing further accounts for why they obtain.
Okay. So within that, it seems like the dispositionalist thinks that there are the regularities that there are in nature, whether they count as law-like, I guess, or not, can be explained, you know, unlike the regularity theorists. There is more to say about them. But unlike the nomological necessitarianism, they don't want to say these are somehow abstract objects. There's something in the objects themselves that explains why they behave the way they do. And the laws are something that are separate from the powers by which objects obey the laws. Is that right?
Yeah, so the standard dispositionalist line on laws is that laws of nature properly conceived are descriptive rather than prescriptive. So most dispositionalists want to say that what we think of as laws of nature are just accurate descriptions of how objects behave, you know, that we can summarize using mathematical equations. But the behavior itself is just rooted in the powers of individual objects, right? So there's no laws that are independent of objects governing them. So laws for most dispositionalists are purely descriptive rather than prescriptive. Whereas, you know, for the nomological necessitarian, laws are genuinely governing prescriptive of individual objects, independent of individual objects, and govern those objects. Now, my own particular take on dispositionalism is a little bit different on this particular issue, but that's how most dispositionalists would want to, describe that contrast.
Okay, on your view, your version of dispositionalism actually entails nomic realism. So could you explain that?
Yeah, so far this has not proven to be a popular view, but it's a little bit outside kind of dispositionalist orthodoxy, but the motivation for this, so the view is roughly this, that if we understand laws of nature as, again, this notion of the other abstract entities that somehow play a governing role in the world, in my view, dispositionalism actually entails that some laws of nature are real in that sense, right? There are these abstract entities that play a governing role. And my argument for that in the book is that that it arises from the notion of ceteris paribus clauses, with respect to dispositions. So just to background this just for a moment, the standard dispositionalist take is that dispositions have a sort of a tripartite identity conditions, right? So a disposition is defined by, or its nature is bound up with three components: stimulus conditions, manifestation conditions, and ceteris paribus clauses. And all those three things together constitute the identity of a particular dispositional property. So, for example, if we think about something, so solubility is a commonly used example. So think about the solubility of salt. So if you drop salt into water, it will dissolve, right? So the stimulus condition there. So the power here is solubility. The object is salt. So if we apply a certain stimulus to the salt, namely we dunk it in water, we're going to get a certain manifestation, namely that the salt will dissolve. So part of what solubility is defined in terms of a stimulus condition and a manifestation condition. But there's also this third component, ceteris paribus clauses. So for example, in the case of salt, we might say that, yes, if you drop salt into water, it will dissolve, unless, for instance, the salt is coated by some protective gel. Or, you might list any number of conditions that might interfere with that normal manifestation in the present. So ceteris paribus clauses are basically they're sets of intervening conditions that might serve to prevent the manifestation of a disposition in the presence of its normal stimulus. So most dispositionalists would say that for any disposition we look at, its identity conditions involve three components: stimulus, the manifestation, and the ceteris paribus clauses. So to bring this back to the issue of, why I want to be both a dispositionalist and believe in laws of nature, my claim is that once we understand a little bit more about the sort of deep ontology of ceteris paribus clauses, we'll recognize that they actually play the functional role of laws of nature, that ceteris paribus clauses do serve as abstract entities that play a governing role in nature, and they play that governing role by, again, being sort of integrated into the identity conditions of a disposition.
So how does it get back to the question of entailing nomic realism?
Well, let's think back to our salt example. I think that the clearest cases of what I'm thinking of here involve alien properties. So properties that are, metaphysically possible, but for whatever reason are not instantiated in our world. So let's think of some arbitrary alien property. Call it glunk. And the role of glunk is to protect salt from being dissolved in water. Right, so if you've got this substance glunk and you append it to salt, it will stop the salt from being dissolved. So let's assume, for the sake of argument, that glunk is a genuinely possible kind of entity, and that it's got this kind of entity has the power to protect salt from being dissolved in water. Now, if that really is a possible natural kind that has that possible causal power of, preserving salt from dissolution, well, then, on my view, among the actual ceteris paribus clauses that figure in the identity conditions of real salt in our world is a reference to, counterfactuals involving this alien natural kind. So salt, as it exists in our world, its ceteris paribus clauses would include reference to this uninstantiated natural kind and its uninstantiated causal powers. And that will then ground the counterfactual truth that, you know, in the presence of glunk, salt will not dissolve in water.
Okay, which is itself a law. Is that the idea?
Yeah, so I think from there we can get to laws. So if this is a genuine, so if reference to this abstract, uninstantiated natural kind and its powers is bound up with the actual identity conditions of real salt, right, because it figures in its ceteris paribus clauses, then in a weird way, you do here have an uninstantiated, purely abstract entity that in an extended sense, at least, serves to govern the behavior of salt in our world. Govern it in the sense that, well, if this natural kind were instantiated, salt would no longer dissolve in water. So that meets the sort of basic criteria for lawhood, right? Because you've got an abstract entity which is playing a governing role of entities in our world. Now, in this case, it's sort of a governing in a very attenuated sense because the natural kind is uninstantiated. But if it's a possible natural kind, I mean, you can imagine a chemist coming up with some substance like this, in which case, that ceteris paribus clause would then actually be realized in nature. And that abstract entity would then, the truth sort of bound up with it, would be manifested in real physical interactions. So I think given an understanding of laws as abstract entities that play a governing role, these uninstantiated universals that figure in ceteris paribus clauses, they actually meet the criteria for lawhood. And if you're a dispositionalist, I think you should believe in ceteris paribus clauses. And by extension, I think you should believe in these uninstantiated abstract entities.
So is the criteria for lawhood just sort of, I don't know, providing the truth maker for a counterfactual?
Yeah, that would be sufficient, I think. So in other words, even if the substance never gets realized and the counterfactual is never actually played out, the fact that that counterfactual is true and made true by this, you know, the abstract entities figuring in the ceteris paribus clauses, that's enough to serve as at least the basic criteria for lawhood.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Okay. So, I mean, there's a number of different topics that you discuss in relation to dispositionalism. And the first and I guess major one is the laws of nature issue. Second one that you talk about is structural realism or ontic structural realism. Could you say a bit about the relationship between that other debate between realism and anti-realism, and then how your version of dispositionalism is related to that debate?
Sure. Well, those who might not be familiar with ontic structural realism, I'll just say a little bit about that first, and then tie it back into positionalism. So in philosophy of science, you know, one of the big long-standing debates is between realism versus anti-realism, where scientific realism is basically the view that science properly aims at achieving knowledge about natural entities in general, including unobservable entities. Right? So if you're a scientific realist, you think part of the job of physics, for instance, is to discover the existence in nature and laws that govern various unobservable fundamental particles. And you'll be inclined to think that with sufficient evidence, we can believe pretty confidently in the actual reality of these unobservable entities and the laws that govern them. So that's the scientific realist view. The scientific anti-realist will take an opposite stance and say that science, properly speaking, aims at making accurate predictions about observable entities, and it's not the job of science to pronounce about the nature or reality of unobservable entities. It's fine to make reference to unobservable entities or theorize about them for purposes of theory development and formulating models and being able to make accurate predictive models. But according to the anti-realist, the scientist, properly speaking, should not really believe in unobservable fundamental particles, for instance. It's fine to talk about them, it's fine to theorize about them, but scientific knowledge is really restricted to the realm of the observable. So that's the debate between scientific realism and scientific anti-realism. There were versions of structural realism earlier in 19th and early 20th century, but it got revived as kind of an actively discussed point of view in philosophy of science by John Worrell in the late 80s. And as initially formulated by Worrell, structural realism is intended to be a kind of moderate compromise between scientific realism and scientific anti-realism. So structural realism, as initially formulated by Worrell, is the idea that scientific anti-realism has part of the story right, insofar as science does not really get knowledge of the existence and nature of unobservable objects. And so science, properly speaking, should not really affirm anything about the existence of or properties of electrons, for example. But that does not mean that science should be barred from all knowledge of the unobservable realm. What Worrell suggested was that science can know about relations obtaining in the unobservable realm. And in particular, it can get plausibly obtain knowledge about the mathematical laws governing the relationships between so-called entities at the unobservable realm. The basic notion, though, is that we can have knowledge about relations in the unobservable realm and structures in the unobservable realm, and in particular, the laws governing the unobservable realm. But we can't know about the individual natures of the objects in the unobservable realm. And so Worrell put this forward as, again, a kind of compromise position between realism and anti-realism. There's some knowledge of the unobservable realm, but no knowledge of unobservable entities, right? Just knowledge about relationships obtaining in the unobservable realm. So that's the basic idea of structural realism. Pretty quickly, it started to develop into... There proliferated multiple different versions of structural realism. So there's an initial split between epistemic structural realism versus ontic structural realism. And then within ontic structural realism, there are now quite a few competing views. And so, yeah, part of what I try to do in the book is just lay out very clearly what all these competing views in the structural realism literature really amount to. Then explore how dispositionalism ties into some of the internal discussions with ontic structural realism.
Okay, yeah. So one of the points you make is that gnomic dispositionalism, right, your version, entails a particular version of ontic structural realism. Is that right?
Yeah, so I make this argument in the course of exploring a couple of fairly major objections that have been leveled against certain versions of ontic structural realism. And what I argue in the book is that the kind of dispositionalism I'm advocating can lead to the formulation of a new version of a moderate ontic structural realism that will sidestep those major objections facing some of the existing versions.
Okay. So there's a number of different, let's see. I mean, there are issues with, you know, what the fundamental stuff is, and the sort of substance ontologies. And you also discuss the relationship between dispositionalism and natural kinds or natural kind essentialism. So, let me turn to the essentialism question, the natural kinds, which I thought was interesting. You argue that dispositionalism is in some way dependent on natural kind essences. So could you perhaps explain that relationship?
Yeah, so one of the chapters in the book explores a really important objection against dispositionalism leveled by Mark Lang and also Ann Whittle. And that objection has to do with the notion that we could quite plausibly do away with dispositions in favor of foundational subjunctive facts. So whereas dispositionalists like to say that, you know, there are all sorts of counterfactual truths or subjunctive facts that apply to objects, and what makes those truths true is their causal powers. What Lang and Whittle suggest is that there are ways that one could do away with the powers as sort of middlemen, right? And just say that, well, there are counterfactual truths that obtain of objects, like, you know, here's what salt would do if you drop it in water. There are counterfactual truths that obtain of objects, but those counterfactual truths are themselves primitive, right? So the counterfactuals are what ground what we would think of as the laws of nature. And you don't need powers brought in as something that supports or grounds these counterfactuals. And what I argue in one of the chapters of the book is that this is actually a pretty substantive objection. This is a serious concern for dispositionalism. And the reply I develop ends up relying on a fairly robust conception of natural kind essentialism. So basically what I argue is that in order to diffuse this objection from Mark Lang, what we need to do is argue that dispositions are grounded in the natural kinds of objects. So, for example, that the electric charge, the negative charge of an electron, would, in the case of an electron, would be grounded in electronhood, right? It'd be grounded in the kind of entity that the disposition is associated with.
Yeah, I guess I'm two different ways to go from there. But let me just continue with the natural kind. I mean, so in, you know, in other areas of metaphysics of science, the whole idea of a natural kind is kind of questioned, whether there are any, or even what, you know, various theories of what natural kinds are. So do you have a particular version of natural kind that you are invoking here?
Yeah, so you're right. The literature on natural kinds is, there are so many highly contested debates going on here. So even, you know, most basically the question of realism, right? Are natural kinds real, or are they theoretical constructs that scientists simply use for purposes of, you know, taxonomic convenience, for classification purposes? Yeah, so there are lots of really key controversies here. So of course the kind of take on the sort of take on natural kinds that I'm advocating here is certainly a realist one. So I'm arguing, I'm adopting the view in this chapter that natural kinds are real and irreducible. But even amongst realists about natural kinds, there are all sorts of controversies about, you know, how to understand the ontology, how to understand the breadth, right? So, you know, there are some advocates of natural kinds, for instance, who say, well, sure, there are natural kinds, but, you know, only in physics and chemistry, but not biology. That's a very commonly defended view. In the book, the sense I'm entertaining is what I refer to as robust natural kind essentialism. So the notion that natural kinds are real, they are genuinely, you know, they're universals, like, again, something like electronhood or humanity in the case of beings, and that they play certain irreducible explanatory roles. And one of their explanatory roles, and this is the one that I'm sort of making use of in the book, is to sort of ground and explain the causal powers of an object. You know, why does a certain object have the powers that it does? Well, because that object belongs to a certain natural kind, and, you know, it's essential to that kind that it have a certain range of powers.
Okay, so, I guess there's a lot of different metaphysical categories that are being invoked. So let me the Mark Lang objection about with subjunctive facts, right? I take it that one of the challenges there is that not only does it seem that you could dispense with dispositions if you've got subjunctive facts, right? But it would seem like as long as you have an ontology of facts, what would you need any other type of truth maker for?
Yeah, part of what's tricky here is that so for some folks in metaphysics who adopt a kind of fact, or, you know, some people refer to a state of affairs, there are disputes about how to use the terminology here. Some people will adopt a kind of fact ontology where facts are real, but they're kind of reducible, right? So if you think of someone like David Armstrong and his view of states of affairs, he didn't really use the fact language as much, but for Armstrong, at least the early Armstrong, for him, it seems to me, what's really foundational was, you know, you've got these bare particulars, and the bare particulars instantiate certain universals. And it's the instantiation by a bare particular of a certain universal that's a fact. Right? And so in the early Armstrong, what's doing the ontological work and the explanatory work for him was really these more basic features, right? The universals, the bare particulars, and instantiation relationship. Later Armstrong's a bit different, but by contrast, you know, if someone is, you might adopt instead a view according to which facts are themselves foundational, and what we think of as universals or as bare particulars, etc., these are just our mental abstractions from concrete states of affairs. The kind of view that Lang is defending, at least at first glance, probably fits in better with that second way of looking at facts. The way he formulates his view himself, I think he can actually, the way he can remain neutral on that, but I think it fits in most easily with that kind of facts as fundamental ontology. Certainly for Lang, you do need to maintain that he's subjunctive facts are foundational in a very real sense of foundational, right? That there are these counterfactual truths that obtain, and there are no additional truth makers for why they obtain, right? These are primitive facts from his perspective.
Okay. But dispositions for you, while they are, we need to posit them for various scientific explanatory purposes, they are not themselves fundamental, or they are?
I think they are, yeah. So I think it's the dispositions that explains why some counterfactual truths are true rather than others.
And then the natural kind essences explain why a particular object has the disposition that it does.
Exactly. Yeah. Sorry, I should clarify that. Right. So dispositions are fundamental in the sense that they're a sort of basic category in nature that we can't reduce to more foundational categories. So they're fundamental in that sense. That said, I do think they're grounded in natural kinds, right? So I think powers exist in objects belonging to natural kinds. So in that sense, they're fundamental but grounded.
Okay. And then, referring back to the controversies, you know, like in biology, for example, natural kinds. I mean, I know, for some people, natural kinds are just, you know, physics and chemistry. You can give more or less pretty clear cutoffs about what belongs and what doesn't. But of course, once you get to biology and more complex systems, that idea gets, you know, sort of torn to shreds. And if you're going to hold that there are natural kinds, you know, in biology or in, you know, social spheres, things like that, you have to relax this idea that the conditions for membership are going to give you clear-cut distinctions. Are you okay with that? I mean, how would that, if you have like fuzzy natural kinds or natural kinds that have kind of fuzzy borders, does that make any difference to the dependence of dispositions on the more fuzzy natural kinds?
Yeah, well, it's good that you emphasize the biological angle here, because the kind of view I'm defending in the book where, you've got powers that belong to objects that, you know, instantiate a natural kind, that ontology is certainly easiest to run if you're restricting your focus to, you know, the kinds that are under discussion in physics and chemistry. When you get to, you know, so-called higher level kinds or alleged kinds, yeah, then the ontology starts to get substantially more complicated. I don't really talk much, I mean, other except for the, you know, the chapter that gets a little bit into philosophy of mind, the chapter on emergentism. In the book, I don't really talk too much about biological kinds and how I think dispositionalism ties into philosophy of biology. But I do have some articles where I get into this to some extent. So I've got a couple of articles where I'm again, defending a fairly unpopular view, namely a kind of intrinsic biological essentialism, a view where there are real natural kinds in biology.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, from what I'm aware of, that's highly controversial, to say the least.
Oh, it totally is. Yeah, this is very much a minority position.
Yeah,
the plausible biology literature.
Well, then let's. You just mentioned emergentism, and I think we have time to talk about that. So you introduce, you know, the notion emergentism in this particular case, and then you also talk at length about I think William Jaworski's more recent version, the sort of a neo-Aristotelian hylomorphism type view. Can you say something about the relationship between your version of dispositionalism and then the hylomorphic variety of emergentism that you focus on?
Sure. Yeah. So William Jaworski, for those who may not be familiar with his work, he works in philosophy of mind. And his main project has been to defend a kind of neo-Aristotelian version of emergentism in philosophy of mind, according to which the notion of structure or form plays a really crucial explanatory role in neuroscience and biology. Whereby what we think of as human cognition and the human mind can be, in a sense, an emergent phenomenon, but still a natural phenomenon, and play this kind of structural organizing role of a physical system. So, Jaworski's project is quite wide-ranging. There's a lot going on there, but that's the basic idea. It's a kind of new version of emergentism in philosophy of mind. It's a naturalistic emergentism, so he's trying to run this account, this neo-Aristotelian account, minus the traditional Aristotelian talk of a soul or teleology or things like that. So where Jaworski's work links into my interests in the book is that in formulating his theory, Jaworski makes very explicit, crucial use of not just dispositionalism, but a particular version of dispositionalism. So earlier you'd asked me about some of these competing versions of the view. Again, one of those competing versions is identity theory. So that's the version that Jaworski employs in his book, where again, identity theory is the idea that all properties are inherently both dispositional and categorical in terms of their basic identity conditions. Again, it's this sort of dual aspect, two-faced view of properties. And so that version of dispositionalism plays an important role in how Jaworski develops and defends this particular, naturalistic emergentist account of mind. So part of what I do in the final main chapter of the book is try to argue that Jaworski's account would work better if he dropped the identity theory version of dispositionalism as a part of his project, and instead pair his view with an idea that's been floated in the ontic structural realism literature in its relation to dispositionalism, namely that there is such a thing as dispositional relations or dispositional structures. So in other words, that the notion of a disposition cuts across multiple ontological categories. So not just dispositional properties, but also dispositional structures. And I try to argue in the book that if Jaworski were to use that understanding of dispositionalism and combine that with his new theory of the mind, that would sidestep certain significant problems that identity theory dispositionalism runs into, in my opinion.
I see. Okay. Are you endorsing dispositional relations and, you know, this sort of cross categorical version of dispositionalism?
That's something I'm not sure of. I do certainly think that dispositions cross-cut ontological categories. I think there's very good reason to maintain that there are substantial dispositions, so powers that fall under the category of substance rather than property. I think there's a very good argument, a very good case to be made for that. I'm less sure about the reality of dispositional relations or dispositional structures, but I certainly think it's an interesting idea and that it can do some explanatory work. And in particular, I think it can do explanatory work in the context of Jaworski's emergentist project.
Okay. So I think I was going to ask perhaps on material composition or substance ontology. Is of those two topics, is there one that you would prefer to tell us about your view of?
Composition's maybe an easier one to get into. It's one that, yeah, your listeners might be a little bit more familiar with.
Okay. This is one area where you think that dispositionalism gets the better hand over its sort of categoricalist competitor. So maybe you can explain that why that's the case.
Sure. Well, we'll just give a bit of background. So the material composition debate, at least this aspect of the material composition debate, the one I'm focusing on, has to do with the ancient question of are material objects infinitely divisible or not? So in other words, if you take a rock and split it in two, and then take each half and split it in two, and keep splitting and splitting and splitting, until you get to pebbles and molecules and atoms, etc. Can that process continue on forever, or do you eventually reach an endpoint? So depending on which answer you give, yes, the process of division has an endpoint, or no, the process of division could go on forever. Depending on which answer you give, you then start to get into these different perspectives on the metaphysics of composition. So if, for instance, you say that this process of division has to have an endpoint, you're going to end up with some version of atomism, where there's two main versions of atomism. One version says that the process of division has an endpoint, and the reason why is that there are these point particles, particles that have no spatial extension at all. And so because they're not extended, of course, they can't be subjected to division. That's one version of atomism. Another version of atomism says that, again, that yes, that the process of division has an endpoint, but it ends in objects that are extended but indivisible. Extended but for some reason just cannot be broken apart. So those are two versions of the yes answer, right? Yes, there is an endpoint to the division process. If instead you say no, that there is no endpoint to the process of division, then again, you end up with two competing views. One view is the theory of gunk, according to which every physical object has proper parts. And so, for any physical object you look at, if you split it into parts, you just get new physical objects that themselves have parts. You split them up, and you just get smaller objects with parts of their own, and they can just go on forever. The fourth view on composition, the fourth main view, agrees that the process of division can go on forever, But it says that, you know, the reason for this is not because every object has proper parts, but instead it's because there are extended simples. So objects that are extended and divisible, but that don't have actual proper parts. So this was Aristotle's view on composition, the extended simples without proper parts notion. So these four main views, and what I argue in the book is that each of those views, so whichever of these four main perspectives you take, each of those four views ends up favoring dispositionalism, either because it entails dispositionalism or more weakly, it sort of raises the probability of dispositionalism against categoricalism.
Okay, so could you give one, you know, without going through all four, in which way is dispositionalism better off with atomism, say, over categoricalism?
Sure. Well, yeah. In fact, that's the easiest one to talk about, I think. So atomism version one. So atomism, according to which nature bottoms out at unextended point particles. That, I think, leads fairly readily into dispositionalism. Once you start asking about, you know, how should we characterize these point particles? What sort of properties could they have? Well, they clearly don't have some of the paradigmatic categorical properties like extension or shape or size, as they're, you know, unextended point particles. So what other kinds of categorical properties might they have? And what I argue is that that's actually a very difficult question to answer. There are, in fact, so what I argue in the book is that there are no uncontroversial examples of purely qualitative properties in fundamental physics that we could attribute to an unextended point particle. That in fact, the most plausible way to think about the properties of such a particle is to think that they're going to be dispositional. In other words, that these point particles are not going to have shape, they're not going to have size, spatial extension. What other kinds of properties can they have? Well, they're not going to have what we would standardly think of as qualitative properties, like obviously like heat or cold or color or something like that. So what kinds of properties does that leave? Well, it's got to leave some kind of non-dispositional, purely qualitative property. And in my view, there are just no examples of such properties uncontroversially in physics that a categoricalist could plausibly point to. Yeah, so that's the kind of argument I make with respect to that first version of material composition.
Okay, very good. So I think we are running out of time at this point. So I wanted to ask what is on the horizon for you now? Are you responding to the apparently many critics of your non-standard dispositionalism, or what are you working on currently?
Oh, well, yeah, thanks for asking. Yeah, so I do have some projects in philosophy of science forthcoming. So I've got a couple of papers on substance ontology coming out. But I've been working more in some other areas lately. So I've got a completed book manuscript in applied ethics that's currently under review, having to do with Canada's new assisted suicide law. So that's under review. I've got another completed book on dealing with some issues on the history of the modern Coptic Orthodox Church. That's also under review. And yeah, so I've got various irons in the fire, and I hope to do some more work on sort of pure dispositionalism in the near future. But at the moment, I'm mostly doing some projects in ethics and theology.
Interesting. Well, sometimes it's good to take a step back and see how people feel, and then come back to things after a while.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think our time is up, but I I appreciate your taking the time to talk with New Books in Philosophy. And I enjoyed reading your book and being reminded of all these basic issues in metaphysics of science and getting a very, very nice, you know, sort of clear review of each of the debates, which was sort of a bonus as far as the, you know, my understanding of the book. So thank you for that.
Well, thanks so much for the opportunity. I've enjoyed this. Thanks.
You've been listening to my interview with Travis Dumsday, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Concordia University of Edmonton. We've been talking about his new book, Dispositionalism and the Metaphysics of Science, which is just out from Cambridge University Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.